You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And it being Friday, and it being the first hour of our Friday program, it is, of course, time for Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders.
Tom, it's good to be with you, and Happy New Year to you and all of the listeners.
Thank you, Bernie. It's our first conversation of the new year. Happy New Year to you, too. Thank you. So, I saw this agenda for 2014 that I got in the, I think it was in the Bernie Buzz, in the newsletter you sent out earlier this week.
Yep.
That was quite impressive.
Well, thanks. What I wanted to do was kind of lay the groundwork for what I think should be an agenda for the coming year as Congress gets back to work, which reflects the needs of a struggling middle class and people living in poverty, and moves this country in a direction toward justice and addresses some of the very serious problems facing our country. You know, somebody told me a long time ago, Tom, it's not so much the answers that you give, it's the questions that you ask.
Hmm.
And I think that what happens in society today, and the corporate media is a major perpetrator of this, we very rarely ask the right questions. And I think we start focusing on real questions and start providing answers. We can move this country forward by rallying the American people to stand with working families and take on the big money interest. But I think the first point is the state of the economy. And I think, you know, we recognize, I do, that the economy today is a heck of a lot better than it was 5 years ago when we were losing 700,000 jobs a month. But if anyone thinks this economy today is anywhere near where it should be for working families and for lower income people, they are sorely mistaken. Real unemployment in this country today is not 7%. That would be too high. Real unemployment, though, is 13%. If you include those people who have given up looking for work and those people who are working part-time when they want to work full-time.
Right.
And by the way, most of the new jobs being created are, in fact, part-time and low-wage jobs. So if we are serious about turning this economy around and paying attention to the needs of working families, we have to focus on the economy. What we have to do is create millions of decent-paying jobs. And as you and I have discussed for a very long time, God only knows there is an enormous amount of work that needs to be done. You got a crumbling infrastructure out there, and that's roads and bridges and water systems, wastewater plants, and a rail system that is way behind the rest of the world, airports that need work. And when you do that, you can put a whole lot of people to work. And I can tell you, given the fact that the weather here in Vermont today is about 10 below zero, in my state and throughout this country, people are wasting enormous amounts of energy because their homes are not properly insulated, they're not weatherized, and we can save a huge amount of money in people's fuel bills. We can cut greenhouse gas emissions and combat global warming, and we can create jobs through a massive energy efficiency program. We can move and should move to sustainable energy, and we create jobs doing that. So there is more than enough work that needs to be done to make our country more productive, and we've got to start investing in those areas, in an education and a number of other areas. So that's one area that we're going to focus on.
Mm-hmm.
A second area, and I want to make a point here, Tom, that is not made often enough. When people, in fact, stand together and get mobilized, they are very, very, very powerful. And I think often we don't fully appreciate that. But let me give you just one example. Over the last several years, in terms of Social Security and Medicare, we have seen a just huge onslaught of effort and hundreds of millions of dollars coming into the political process from these people who are saying, we have got to cut Social Security, we have got to cut Medicare, we have got to cut Medicaid. And you have people like Pete Peterson, who is a Wall Street billionaire who has spent literally hundreds of millions of dollars setting up organizations and putting pressure on Congress to do that. You had this Simpson-Bowles committee working on that. They wanted to do that. You had the President of the United States talking about a chained CPI for Social Security, which is a cut in the Social Security. All of that pressure. You had the whole Republican Party out there saying, we got to cut Social Security and Medicare. Well, you know what? Social Security and Medicare was not cut.
Right.
And you know why it was not cut, Tom?
Well, I think in large part because you were on that damn committee.
It was not cut because people all over the country said, no,
yeah.
You ain't going to do that. I was part of an effort with a number of progressive groups, which in a very short period of time brought forth 700,000 names on a petition saying, do not cut Social Security and Medicare. Now, yeah. I'm not saying that these guys are going to give up. I'm not saying that they're not going to be back, you know, next week and going to continue the fight. They want, that's what they believe. I mean, what our right-wing billionaires believe is, some of them, Koch brothers and others, that we should eliminate Social Security, make massive cuts in Medicaid, transform Medicare into a very different program than it is right now. So they're not going away. But I do want to tell all of the people out there, when folks stand up and when polls show that 60, 70, 75% of the people say, no, that's a pretty dumb idea, don't do that, you know what? Congress ends up listening. And we have got to work on that premise that on issue after issue, the American people are not as divided as some of the media pundits think that they are. When you ask the average American, and polls indicate this, should we invest heavily to create jobs in America? The American people say, yeah, we should. And when the American people are asked, do you think we should end these huge tax loopholes so that one out of four corporations in America doesn't pay a nickel in federal taxes? You know what the American people say? Yeah, we should. So I think on many, many issues of fair taxation, of job creation, of raising the minimum wage, of protecting Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, and other very important programs, the divisions in this country are not all that great. What ends up happening is the moneyed interests in Washington have a very, very different agenda. And their agenda is more tax breaks for the wealthy, maintaining and maybe expanding these tax loopholes for large corporations, cuts in Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, Education, Environmental Protection Agency, et cetera, et cetera. And that particular point of view represents maybe 20, 25% of the American people.
Yeah.
So what our job is to rally the American people around an agenda that makes sense for the middle class. And when we do that, we're going to give our Republican friends an offer they can't refuse. And that is, if they choose to go forward on an agenda which represents 20, 25% of the American people, they're not going to stay in office.
Mm-hmm. And all the polls show that the people are with you. It's just all the money is on that side.
That is exactly the dynamic. Yeah. All of the polls and what the American people are saying is they understand the middle class is hurting. And they want to see efforts to expand the middle class and protect the vulnerable people in this country. That's what the American people say. What Wall Street and the big money interests are saying is, no, we want to pay. We're billionaires. Hey, I got $3 billion. That's not enough. I need more money. Cut my taxes. I don't care if you cut food stamps or you don't extend unemployment benefits for workers who are living hand to mouth. So there is a real split between what the American people want and what the Republican agenda is. What I am trying to do with other members of the Senate is to get the Democrats to be tougher, to be stronger, to raise that issue. I, you know, would be delighted, and I'll do my best, you know, to bring forth a vote on the Senate floor. If my Republican friends really want to cut Social Security, let them have a vote to do that.
Hmm.
You know what? I think when, in the light of day, not too many of them are going to press that yes button.
Yeah. Yeah, put it on the record.
That's what I think the job is. I think we've got to focus on the economy. I think we've got to keep defending Social Security and Medicare. I think we have to take a very hard look at Wall Street, as I have said many, many times. When you have a situation where these banks that were bailed out because they were too big to fail are, without exception, in terms of the largest banks in this country, larger today than they were before we bailed them out, that makes no sense to me at all. And I think we've got to be thinking hard about breaking up these huge Wall Street banks.
There you go. Sounds like an agenda for 2014 to me. We will be back with your calls for Senator Bernie Sanders right after this in our Brunch with Bernie segment here on the Tom Hartman Program. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
By the way, be sure to check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. I mentioned his newsletter where I read the agenda. You can sign up for it. It's free. It's right over there at sanders.senate.gov. And welcome back. Senator Sanders is with us, and Russell in South Whitley, Indiana, watching us on the Dish Network on Free Speech TV, on TV, on Dish Satellite TV. You are on the air, Senator Sanders. Russell.
This is Russell Medley, and
yes, sir.
I'm from South Whitley, Indiana, and I've been watching your show, and there's one thing that bothers me, and that is the unemployment system that we have in this country is all wrong. The companies that supply the jobs gets taxed for the people that is laid off. It should be we're buying Chinese junk, and it should be that they should put a tax on everything and then pay back a bonus to every American job to the company that supplies an American job.
Are you talking about a tariff, import tariffs?
Well, no. Make it a sales tax for unemployment.
Oh, I see.
Okay.
Bernie,
well,
thoughts on that, Bernie?
An issue. Tom and I have talked about it on a number of occasions. And that is that we have, and it has to be admitted, a bipartisan trade policy, which includes NAFTA and CAFTA and permanent normal trade relations with China. And now the administration is looking at a TPP, a Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement. And in my view, and as somebody who has voted, Russell, against all of these trade agreements, I think they have been a disaster for American workers, and they have been something that the multinational corporations have benefited very significantly from. And the bottom line is, this is not all that complicated. If you have the option of going to Vietnam or China and paying people very, very low wages and not have to worry about environmental considerations or unions and so forth and so on, or you stay in the United States and you pay people $15 or $20 an hour and you have to provide health care and protect the environment, it's not a very tough choice for many of these companies. And that's why they have shut down many, many manufacturing plants in this country, and why white-collar jobs as well are going to low-wage countries. And I think it doesn't make sense, and that's why I voted against all of these trade agreements.
So what are your thoughts on ongoing unemployment benefits? How do you think this...
Well, I believe, my understanding is that next week when the Senate returns, extending unemployment benefits will be one of the very first issues that are up. I will be very, very supportive of that effort because it just seems to me that when long-term unemployment is almost at record levels, and that is that you have a lot of older workers out there who, for whatever reason, lost their jobs, very, very difficult for them to find new jobs, and they're out there hurting. And unemployment benefits is a significant part of the income they receive. And you cut that off, those people are really going to be in really bad, bad shape. So I think it's unfair to really hurt these 1.3 million Americans, and that number is going to go up during the course of this year. And second of all, an economist have made this point. If these unemployed workers don't have a source of income, they're not going to be spending money. And if they're not spending money, the result is that I think it's something, a loss of about 160,000 jobs and about a 0.2% reduction in the GDP. So it's bad economics, and it's certainly very cruel policy to shut the door on the faces of these workers.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us. We'll be back with more of your questions for Bernie right after this. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It is our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. And, Bernie, you were just mentioning that when Congress comes back, you expect that probably the first thing Harry Reid is going to bring to the floor of the Senate will be renewing unemployment benefits. And I just had a quick question I wanted to ask you of that, if I may take a moderator's privilege here. I'm reading that they may ask for fast-track ability or privilege for that. In order to, you know, let it go through quickly and without amendments and all that kind of thing. And this is the sort of thing everybody loves, so it might get granted. If they did pass fast-track authority as a separate piece of legislation and then used it for unemployment, would it still be there to be used for TPP? Is this a sneaky back way of getting fast-track ready for TPP?
Are you talking about using fast-track for extending unemployment benefits?
Correct.
I don't think it works that way, Tom. I think what you may be referring to is asking for unanimous consent.
Okay. Okay. So
unanimous consent is the effort to expedite the process in a dysfunctional U.S. Senate.
Right.
Do I believe that the Republicans will give us unanimous consent to move this thing forward quickly? No, I doubt that very much.
Yeah. Okay.
But your other point about fast track for TPP is something that some of us will vigorously oppose.
Yeah. Okay, good. I don't know Senate procedures as well as you do. Thank you for setting me straight. Mark in Chico, California, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I'm a disabled Vietnam veteran, and I called about the TPP and this fast track. And, you know, it's bad for the American people. And I believe it's 20 years today that NAFTA was passed, which destroyed our economy, too, besides the Reagan administration. And since Elizabeth Warren isn't running, are you willing to stick your neck out and go out there and put some ideas out for the people and run for president?
Well, let me just say two things. In terms of the TPP and trade policies, as I mentioned a moment ago, I agree with you. I was in the House of Representatives when NAFTA was voted upon. We worked as hard as we could with the unions and with a whole lot of people talking about how it was going to open up the floodgates for companies to ship jobs abroad. And I think history has proved that right. So we're going to do everything that we can to prevent the fast track for TPP. We're going to oppose it very, very strongly. The goal here is that corporate America has got to reinvest in a country called the United States of America, not in China, not in Vietnam, and start creating decent-paying jobs here. In terms of running for president, what I have said is that I think we are in a pivotal moment in American history, and decisions are going to be made now and in the very near future, which will determine whether, in fact, the middle class of this country survives. And there are issues that have to be raised, and there are solutions that have to be brought forward that represent working people. I do not wake up in the morning with some burning desire to become president of the United States. It is an impossibly difficult job. And so, you know, it's not something that I, feel that I have to do. But I do believe that somebody has got to raise these issues and has to fight for working families. And if there aren't other people coming forward who may be more qualified than I, or have better financial resources than I, then I would be prepared to do that. So the answer is, you know, I'm giving thought to it, but we have a long way to go before we have to make a decision on it.
Jeff in San Francisco, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Senator. My question's about student loans. My wife and I currently have about $75,000, $80,000 in student loans, but we don't qualify for one of those forms because we had them open prior to, I believe it was 2005. We opened them up in the 90s. Well, she got her PhD and I got my teaching credential and master's. So I was wondering if any way we can amend that to qualify for people who opened them up earlier and still have this massive debt and are paying huge interest rates on them, if we could qualify and possibly we can amend that with the Republicans by limiting the amount you could have is up like to $250,000. Because I believe currently you could have a large amount than that.
Well, Jeff, let me just say this. I'm a member of what's called the Health, Education, and Labor Committee, which is going to be looking at higher education reauthorization bill. And this is certainly an issue that is going to come up. And you've touched on, I think, one of the significant problems facing millions and millions of people, and that is, A, the high cost of college and the fact that many people like yourself and your wife are leaving school deeply in debt. They spend year after year after year paying off of those debts. In fact, I bumped into somebody in Vermont, my memory is correct, where the mother is still paying off her debts, and she's helping to pay off her kids' debt as well. And we now have, I think, student indebtedness, if you can believe it. There's more student indebtedness in this country than there is credit card indebtedness. So it is a huge problem, people paying very high interest rates. So very simply stated, Jeff, there are a lot of things that we can and must do to make sure that middle class and working class people are not forced to pay forever very high interest rates on their college loans. There are a number of ideas out there, and that is something that I will be fighting very hard to do. So it is not only, I mean, I can go on and on about what it does, But one of the other things that it does is that there are a lot of young people out there who are saying, you know what, I don't know if I want to go to college and come out $50,000 in debt or $100,000 in debt. So it is an issue that has to be dealt with, and I hope we'll deal with it shortly.
Well, we got about 30 seconds of the break. Any specifics you think might happen?
Well, I think what we have to do is, among other things, put a maximum interest rates for some people are much, much too high. Second of all, I think the federal government should not be making a profit on student loans. I think that that is wrong. So I think if we move forward in those directions, we can make some significant progress.
Sounds like a great start. Senator Bernie Sanders is with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. We'll be back with more of your questions for Bernie right after this break. Be sure to check out his website. It's at sanders.senate.gov. You can sign up for his newsletter, the Bernie Buzz, there. And it's also a great news aggregating site. A lot of good news and information you can find there. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Also, I'm assuming over at sanders.senate.gov, you can see Senator Sanders' letter to Keith Alexander asking if the NSA is spying on our senators. Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. It is our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. And Larry in Pulaski, Pennsylvania. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, Bernie. I'm really concerned about the cost of living on Social Security. I appreciate it very much that when you're talking, that you talk to the people out here in TV land. Because the people you're talking to there in that chamber, it does no good. If you just could talk to the people out here in TV land, use the Bill Clinton thing. Say, get your pencil out. It's easy to figure out. You people on Social Security, figure out what you're getting now on Social Security and when you went on it. Then they can do the math themselves, and that just eliminates a lot of chit-chat. If you could do that, please, just talk to the people out there in TV land, because them people across the other aisle is like talking to a commode. That's all I have to say. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Larry.
Well, Larry, we do try to do that. And the reason we have such an active website, and that is sanders.senate.gov, and we do a Bernie Buzz, which I think provides a whole lot of good information, and why we try very hard, both in Vermont and around the country, to keep people informed about what's going on, is just for the reason that Larry indicated. I think the way we're going to make change in this country is when people know what's going on and put pressure on Washington and kind of make them an offer they can't refuse, and that is, if they don't do the right thing, they're not going to get returned to office. But in terms of Social Security, very, very briefly, the immediate good news, I think we have beaten back attacks to cut Social Security, which came from virtually every Republican and a lot of billionaire Wall Street guys and so forth. But the bad news, and where we have got to continue going forward, and this is, I've offered legislation on this for several years now, is that when some of my colleagues say that, well, gee, we have to reduce Social Security benefits and the cost of living adjustment, the truth is that, in my view at least, seniors are getting less than they should because the spending habits and practices of seniors are different than the general population. Seniors spent most of their money on prescription drugs, on health care, on food, on keeping warm. And those costs are going up a lot faster than flat-screen TVs or computers or things that younger people might buy. So one of the many things we're trying to do is develop a separate index for seniors, which I think will reflect in them getting higher cost-of-living adjustments.
Lonnie in Baltimore, Maryland. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello.
Hello, Lonnie.
Hi. I have first good evening to Mr. Bernie and you to Mr. Tom. I have two questions. As far as the college tuition, all the money that they make off these college athletes and everything, how come some of this money can't be put towards the tuition of the college students? And all these jobs that are being shipped out of the country, how come they can't be taxed when they try to ship the product back into the country so it balances?
All right, well, Lonnie has asked two interesting questions. I think one of the issues that some of us are concerned about in terms of the quality of college education is that while tuition is going up and up and up, some of these colleges are investing not just in huge amounts of money in athletic programs and paying, unbelievable salaries to college football coaches and so forth and so on. They're investing in these very fancy and kind of four-star dormitory rooms and et cetera, rather than on focusing on how we give our young people the best education possible in a highly competitive world. So I think, Larry makes a good point about that, and maybe we should be investing more in teachers and curriculum and a little bit less than football stadiums and stuff. Second point is again an issue that has come up on this show and comes up on virtually every show, and that is people understand, especially I think during the holiday season when people go out shopping and they find it harder and harder to buy products made in the United States of America. Everything is made in China, or it's made in Vietnam, or it's made in Bangladesh, or it's made, in countries all over the world where people have paid pennies an hour. And all of that is a result of our trade policies pushed by corporate America to make it easier for companies to shut down in this nation. And we've lost tens of thousands of factories in the last 10 years, millions of jobs. They go abroad and they bring their products back in. What Lonnie is talking about is a tariff. And that's something this country has had for a very long time until the trade agreements kind of wiped them out in many respects. So I agree with Lonnie.
Ross in Coos Bay, Oregon. Ross, you're on the air with Senator Sanders. Thanks for listening to 1340 AM.
Thank you. Hello, Senator Sanders.
Hi, Ross.
And thank you for taking my call, Tom. I'm a big fan and big supporter of your show. It's my first time to call in. I'm a progressive that lives on the Oregon coast, and I work as a mental health provider for the local and state government. And we just found out recently that we're getting 3,000 more people on state Medicaid. And we're a very small local mental health clinic. And I'm actually really concerned about how we're going to absorb all these new patients.
Well, Ross, thank you very much for asking that very important question. I mean, the good news is that as a result of the Affordable Care Act, millions of people who previously were ineligible for Medicaid will get Medicaid. Other people will get affordable health insurance through their federal or statewide exchange, and that's all good news. But what that means is you're going to have a lot of folks out there who now have insurance, who have serious needs, whether it is physical, whether it is mental health needs, and they're going to be looking for providers. And today we are very, very weak as a nation in terms of primary health care and in terms of our capabilities regarding mental health, which what Ross is talking about. So I think Ross is expressing the concern. You're going to have a lot of people flocking into these facilities, and we're not going to have the capability or the infrastructure to deal with that. And I think in some parts of the country, he's right. Let me just tell you what I have done on this and will continue to do. As part of the Affordable Care Act, I fought very hard to get an $11 billion appropriation for the expansion of community health centers, which are in Oregon and in Vermont and all over this country. And they are a very important source of providing primary health care and mental health counseling and low-cost prescription drugs and dental care to people throughout this country. And as a result of what we did in the Affordable Care Act, hundreds and hundreds of new community health centers have been established all over America. We have got to do more. But Ross's point is that we need to improve our infrastructure in terms of delivery of mental health as well as primary care is absolutely right. So we made some progress, but we have a long way to go.
Edmund in Hot Springs National Park. I'm assuming
Happy
that's
year,
Georgia.
Gentlemen. I have a question. I think we all agree that we have two different kinds of economies in our country. But my question is, how can we expect to have a fair economy for everyone when we can't demand for fair justice system? I'm referring to branding Mr. Snowden as a traitor and asking for him to be accountable for what he's done. I am not privy to information whether or not he's a traitor or he's a whistleblower, but I know for a fact that Mr. Clapper perjured himself under oath in Congress, and we haven't demanded, and no one has asked anything about that and trying to do anything about it.
Well, some of us are trying to do something about it. I happen to believe that the NSA is an agency that is essentially out of control. I think that terrorism remains a serious issue. We have to do everything we can to protect the American people, but I believe very strongly we can do that under the Constitution of the United States. And I think what the NSA is doing is clearly unconstitutional. And some of us are going to work very hard to rein the NSA in. It's not just that virtually every telephone call is collected and on file, knowing who called who and at what time and where. It appears that the NSA is getting into people's emails, going into websites that people visit. And that, to my mind, is not what a free country is about. So I think you have this explosion in technology, which gives the government, and by the way, the private sector, the capability of doing all kinds of things that a few years ago nobody dreamed that they could. But just because they have the technology doesn't mean that they should be doing it. And I don't want everybody in America to be looking over their shoulders, whether it's the government or whether it is the private sector invading their privacy. This is a huge issue, and we have got to address it.
Do you think the we just have 30 seconds, Bernie. Do you think the Congress will be addressing these Fourth Amendment issues coming up?
They will. There's no question, but they will. The question is how aggressively will they do that?
Yeah. And is your sense that Senator Reid's on with this or the Democrats?
Well, I think you have the Judiciary Committee doing a better job, I think, than the Intelligence Committee.
Mm-hmm.
But some of us feel very strongly that you can't give a blank check to the NSA and the other intelligence agencies to be able to collect all kinds of data in cases where 99.9% of the people have nothing to do with terrorism. That's just not what America is supposed to be about.
It is 15 minutes before the hour. We'll be back with more Senator Sanders right after this. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. You can check out Bernie's website at sanders.senate.gov and sign up for his newsletter. His free newsletter. It's called the Bernie Buzz. Get all the information about what's going on in the world, and particularly here in Washington, D.C. Right.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And later on today, we'll have Anything Goes Friday. So stick around. Welcome back. And let's see here. Randy in Smock, Pennsylvania, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good afternoon, Senator. I believe the Trans-Pacific is going to benefit no one but corporations. If the vote was held this week, how do you think the Senate would vote on that? And please define fast track. Thank you.
Okay. Randy asked what the vote would be in the Senate. Obviously, I don't know exactly what the vote would be, but if Randy is asking me, do I think it would carry in the Senate? Yeah, I do. All of the major trade agreements have carried in Congress, and I see no reason to believe why this one would not carry as well. You got all kinds of moneyed interest and corporate interest behind it, and when corporate America talks, the Senate usually listens. I can tell you absolutely, Randy, that there are a number of us who are very, very concerned about this legislation and will vote against it. Now, in terms of fast track, what fast track is about, interestingly enough, it is what the term implies. It is a means by which legislation can move very, very quickly through the Senate. The Senate, as I think most people know, is a very complicated institution where if one person jumps up and say, I object, I don't want to move this thing forward, you can slow it down interminably. And we see that every single day. The Republicans, in fact, have done more obstructionism in the last 5 years than any time in the history of this country. So it's very easy to slow down legislation
and very easy to obstruct it. What a fast-track provision is, it says you can't do that. There aren't going to be any amendments. There'll be a time on it. We'll vote for fast-track, and then in X number of days or weeks, we're going to vote up or down what the bill will be. That's what fast-track is about. So it's an unusual mechanism to move a piece of legislation very, very rapidly, and that's what the proponents of TPP want to do. So that's something that I will very strongly oppose.
Okay, Mike, in Lewisburg, Missouri, I think, Mike, you're on the air with Senator Sanders. I think he might have already answered your question.
Yeah, he has. Bernie, this is Mike Wilson. I'm 100% disabled Vietnam veteran, and I want you to run for president.
Well, thank you for that.
I have been watching you forever. My sister lives in Vermont. She shook your hand in a factory up there before, and we talk about you all the time.
Mike, we have just 30 seconds.
Thank you very much, Mike, and thanks very much for your service to our country. And I should tell you, by the way, as a Vietnam vet, that what we are trying to do on the Veterans Committee, which I chair, is really take some very significant steps forward to protect veterans in this country. We've got some really good legislation that got through the committee, and now I've got to get it onto the floor and get it passed. But, Mike, thank you very much for your support and for your service to our country.
It's a good one. It's definitely a good one. We have 15 seconds before the break. Thought you want to share?
Well, again, the main point that I hope that everybody appreciates is that Congress is way out of touch with where the American people are. The American people understand the economic crises they face. They want us to work for them, and yet big money interests continue to win on issue after issue, and that's what we've got to change.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. We'll be back with more of Senator Sanders taking your calls right after this. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. And Ron, watching us on the Internet in Santa Maria, California. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, I think we all get caught up too often in talking about good jobs versus bad jobs. And I would challenge you to maybe go ahead and talk about the difference between a good job and a bad job. I think we all know many of the traits that are associated with a good job versus a bad job. Number one, pay. Number two, benefits. But what ends up happening by doing that is we devalue the, I don't know if you want to call them bad jobs, but that's what gets into our heads. They're bad jobs. Well, then who wants to do that? So today Rand Paul had talked about, we don't want to extend unemployment benefits because it gets people to, I don't know whether he thinks they'll become lazy or shiftless or whatever it is. Well, when you put, for many, the crappy job, let's just call it, or unemployment, they may very well take unemployment at that point. I think we need to make the bad jobs decent jobs, let's just call it. I'd love to hear your comment.
Well, Ron, one of the reasons, well, let me tell you what a bad job is. A bad job is a job that pays you a wage that at the end of the week, after working 40 hours for that week and after paying your rent and your car payments and your health care and everything else, you're worse off than you were before you started working. That's a bad job. A bad job is when your employer doesn't give you any sick leave. A bad job is when you have virtually no benefits at all. A bad job is when you have no protection on the job from being humiliated. I talked to a woman recently, and she said that, you know, she had no sick time or very little sick time, and in order to get off, she had to get a doctor's note, and by the time she got the note, she couldn't get an appointment with a doctor and all this other stuff. You know, the dignity on the job as well. So I think, you know, Ron makes a good point, and that is that what we want to do is take jobs which today are not good jobs and make them better jobs. And how do we do that? We do that by raising the minimum wage to a living wage. We do that by providing health care to all people and do what every other major country on earth is doing, have a national health care program. Then you do that, that's going to be there for every worker in America. You do that by creating an economy by which employers can provide other types of benefits. We are losing big time the defined retirement plans that made life so much better for so many people. So, you know, I think that's kind of the direction that we've got to go.
Paul in South Lyon, Michigan. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yeah, Bernie, you're a swell guy, but I hope you don't run for president like Ralph Nader did and give the Republicans a chance to steal another election. But anyway, my question is, George Bush Sr. administration wrote NAFTA, and President Clinton, I understand, added protections for American jobs and the environment. And after he signed it, 22 million jobs were created, and wages rose during the Clinton administration. So why did NAFTA cost us jobs after Bush became president?
Well, Paul, first of all, it's not my intention to do anything if I decide to run for president that would make it easier for a Republican to win. So rest assured about that. I'm not sure in terms of NAFTA and jobs, it's almost humorous how the analyses are done. But the bottom line is, Paul, it is my very strong opinion based on fact that NAFTA has cost us a significant number of jobs. And it's not just the question of Clinton versus Bush. It is a question of what these trade agreements have done under all administrations. We have seen in industry after industry a significant loss of factories and manufacturing jobs. And I think that these trade agreements have worked very much to the detriment of the average American. They are pushed by corporate America. They benefit corporate America, and that's why they were passed, and that's why they're still fighting for even more.
Detroit Johnny O in Romulus, Michigan. We got about 2 minutes before the end of the hour. Quick one, Johnny.
Great, Tom. Yeah, a real good friend of mine. He works as an ADT security guy. You know, installing alarms during the day, and he's a musician by night. He's around 55, one of my best friends. He made a statement the other day that Social Security is a Ponzi scheme. What is this guy talking about? Is he nuts? He's a Rand Paul supporter, too, by the way.
Well, you know, what bothers me, Johnny, is there are a lot of working people who watch too much Fox and listen to too much Rush and just get their facts very, very wrong. Social Security today has a $2.7 trillion surplus and can pay out every benefit owed to every eligible American for the next 20 years. Social Security for 70-plus years, ever since it was established, and this is just an extraordinary record, has paid out every nickel owed to every eligible American, without exception, in bad times economically and in good times. Does Social Security sound like a Ponzi scheme to you? Some of the right-wing guys come up and they say, Social Security, that $2.7 trillion is all IOUs. All that they mean by that absurd remark is that what Social Security does, as they should, is they invest that money in treasury bonds. And they gain interest on that, which adds to the Social Security surplus. But for some of these people, they assume that when you own a treasury bond, and by the way, the United States government has never failed to pay its debt ever, they think that this is some kind of bogus fund and that this money is not real. That is nonsense. Social Security is strong and will continue to be strong, and with very modest changes, we can make it strong for the next 70 or 75 years. What you should be aware of, Johnny, and what your friends should be aware of, these folks who are bad-mouthing Social Security, they want to privatize Social Security, they want to end Medicare as we know it, they want to make massive cuts in Medicaid, they want to do away with the EPA and the Department of Energy. These people have a real right-wing agenda, and it is funded by billionaires. Now, it doesn't upset me that billionaires believe that. You know, they want to pay less in taxes. It does upset me that any working person in this country who needs Social Security and Medicare would believe that stuff for one moment.
Bernie, thanks so much for being with us this week.
My pleasure. And again, Happy New Year to everybody.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Sanders. And be sure to check out Bernie's website at sanders.senate.gov. We'll be right back.
Listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's Friday. We will be getting to Anything Goes Friday in a little bit. But first, Senator Sherrod Brown is with us. And it's always a pleasure to have the Senator drop by. Brown.Senate.gov, his website, as well as SherrodBrown.com. And, Senator, welcome back to the program.
Good to be back. Thanks, Tom. Happy New Year.
Thank you. And Happy New Year to you. It's nice talking with you in this first week of the new year. Tragically, over a million Americans lost their unemployment insurance over the last week or week and a half as a consequence of Paul Ryan apparently digging his heels in that committee with Patty Murray and company. And the federal minimum wage is still stuck where it's been for far too long. You probably know right off the top of your head, but however long it's been. Your thoughts on where we're going to go with these issues, where the Senate is going, and what are you doing?
A number of us in the Senate are going to insist on doing both when we return. We in next Monday, unemployment insurance and minimum wage. Underscore unemployment is insurance. It's one of the, it's like Medicare. It's like Social Security. You pay into it, and if you need it, you get benefits. And if you're never laid off, then you've paid into the social insurance program. If you're laid off, you've earned these benefits, and it's really as simple as that. It's not welfare, and in fact, when you're receiving these benefits to receive them, you need to be looking for a job. And this kind of mean-spiritedness, where blaming the unemployed for being unemployed, blaming low-wage workers for their low wages when they qualify for the SNAP program for food stamps, is a pretty unforgiving time in American history in that way.
Yeah, well, and you've got Republican senators now who want to amp it up by saying, oh, and by the way, if you want those benefits, you have to pee in a cup.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's
and you've got a, well, I won't even go into the guy that the hypocrite from Florida that got himself in a situation of illegal activity while advocating that food stamp beneficiaries need to pee in a cup, as you say. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. He just came back to Congress, didn't he? In any case, there was a time in this country when, Franklin Roosevelt said, the best welfare program is a job. And he said, I'm not going to give people welfare. I'm going to give them jobs. And he created the WPA and the CCC and dozens of other, typically three-letter agencies, and put America back to work. It cut our unemployment rate in half in 3.5 years. Is that have we just lost sight of that altogether? And or is that sort of, after the recession of 2001, the 9/11 recession? Did George Bush do the exact same thing, only it was called the war in Iraq and the war in Afghanistan? In other words, he doubled our military budget. He put a lot of people to work, but he didn't say, I'm doing this to put people to work. But the effect was that it kind of helped the economy a little bit.
In a not very efficient way, too. $1 billion in military spending doesn't create nearly the putting aside any question of military adventurism of a decade ago, but $1 billion in military spending doesn't create nearly the jobs of $1 billion building a highway or $1 billion in AmeriCorps program or something else.
Right.
I, you know, it, it, I heard Chairman Bernanke speaking not too long ago to a business group that probably didn't really absorb what he said, because he really was responding in the way only chairman of the Fed respond and talk about things. But he was responding to this whole idea of austerity. You just keep cutting and cutting and cutting as if that's going to grow the economy. And he went back a decade plus to the same era you're talking about, that when we came out of that recession, we actually increased employment, not just in the private sector, but also in the public sector, to the tune of hundreds of thousands of jobs. In this recovery, is anemic as it's been in some ways, the number of public sector jobs has actually declined. So there are, in relevant terms, relative terms, there are about 1 million more jobs in the public sector, fewer jobs in the public sector now than there were coming out of that recession, because we increased jobs there and decreased jobs now. And what that means is, if you're trying to grow the private sector, and we've done that at a not terrible pace, at a fairly significant pace, we've seen pull back down because of layoffs of teachers and firefighters and librarians and other public sector workers. So you can't really grow your way out of all this if you just keep cutting spending. And that's what Republican House has insisted on. It's what Paul Ryan, as you point out, who played a major role in stopping unemployment insurance from being extended, what he's done and what he and his ilk have done in this.
They're essentially saying that we can cut our way to prosperity. To the best of my knowledge, that's never happened in any country anywhere in the world. Am I missing something?
Yeah, I think that's right. And somehow that view of everything's about reducing the budget to have economic growth, and it's they use the term pro-growth policies and tax breaks for the job creators and all the things they say, which simply, I mean, we've tried this. We've seen what Europe's done. We've seen how we've come out of this recession, and there's just no evidence that you cut your way to prosperity. There's evidence that you invest. We should be investing in infrastructure. We should be investing in preschool. We should be investing in community colleges and education and health clinics and all of those things that serve the public and create and sort of set the table for long-term growth and actually increase short-term job creation at the same time. And that's what's sorely been missed in these last 5 years.
Yeah. Do you think it's possible that, my conspiracy theory is that these guys are basically saying, if we can reduce government involvement in these things, that's more opportunities for us to make a buck off it. So every, $100 billion we get, or every $1 billion we can take out of public education, we can replace that with $1 billion in for-profit education, and we can skim $100 million off the top. Every $1 billion we take, on and on and on, do away with all these government programs, and now we can make a buck on prisons, on schools, fill in the blanks.
Am I
too cynical?
Yeah, They were cynical, but it's probably, there's a lot to it. What 10 years ago, a dozen years ago, or even maybe 15 years ago in the early Gingrich years, and kind of the Gingrich then Hastert delay years, there was all the talk of privatization of everything, privatized prisons, privatized education. There was even talk of privatizing the national parks, a whole host of issues where they don't talk about it quite the same now, but by cutting spending, you're doing a lot of that. And they get the extra benefit now of being able to criticize the President of the United States for anemic economic growth as they do these things. So their philosophy fits perfectly in cutting spending, shifting as much to the private sector as you can, and then blaming President Obama for this economic this anemic economic growth we've seen in the last 4 years.
Right. And in the last minute we have here, I'm curious your thoughts on the minimum wage. Where should it go, and where what's probably going to happen?
Well, it should go bigger than we're trying to do, but we're just going to keep trying this year. I think there's going to be vote after vote after vote. The last time we increased it was a good bit of pressure on Republicans, but George Bush was president. He signed it. We got a good bipartisan vote in 2007. The minimum wage for tipped employees has been stuck at $2.13 an hour since 1991 for more than 20 years.
Wow.
And this minimum wage hasn't been increased by Congress. Overall minimum wage in six plus years. So we need to raise the tip minimum wage, which we're going to in our bill, up to 70% of the full minimum wage. We are raising it 90 cents three times immediately upon enactment, and then twice more, and we're going to index it this time, something that should have been done a long time ago. So we're not going to give up on this. This is a small part of the whole idea of this is a whole a small part of the dealing with wage inequality, but it's something clearly we need to do, and it's got to be a piece of the puzzle.
Well said. Well done. Senator Sherrod Brown, sherrodbrown.com and brown.senate.gov. Senator Brown, thank you for dropping by.
Tom, always. Thanks for the service you do.
Good talking to you. Thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And we'll be back with Anything Goes Friday. From this point forward, I got a couple little rants, but we'll pick up your calls. And welcome back. Bill in Bandon, Oregon, listening on Free Speech or watching on Free Speech TV. Hey, Bill, what's on your mind today?
Hey, I'm really concerned about this unemployment insurance. The minimum wage needs fixing too, but the unemployment insurance program needs to be reformed. You know, an extension to provide the opportunity to reform it is absolutely necessary. But in my view, if you've been looking for a job for 26 weeks and you haven't found one, you're looking for the wrong job. You have to get yourself retrained. But who can afford that?
Right.
So my proposal is that the federal government establish a training program, not a contracted training program where we pay these scam artists money to perform what they call training that isn't, but a federally run program. You can maybe hire people to do some of the training, but they should get paid only when their students get a job. Mm-hmm. And they should get a premium each time one of their students gets a good job.
And no student
and
loans
would,
for this.
Beg pardon?
And no student loans for this. People shouldn't have to pay for this training.
No. I'm not. I'm talking about a part of the benefit. You have to give them some money to live on while they're taking the training.
Right.
But they also need to have the training provided to them.
Yeah. Here's part of the problem, Bill. Our trade policies, in particular, and our tax policies, and secondarily, our trade policies really are a subset of our tax policies, have moved so many jobs overseas. It's not like there is a sector in the United States where there is demand for jobs and not enough people to fill them. So why don't we instead be bringing jobs back by changing our trade policies?
Well, I certainly support that as well, but I think that there are a lot of jobs that are going unfilled, and there should be more jobs. And some of the delay in getting the people employed is getting the jobs back here is not having people
where
do the jobs.
Yeah, I'm genuinely not trying to be contentious here at all, but I don't know of any sector where there are employers looking for employees really aggressively. Do you?
I don't know about aggressively, but I know that if we had more people who were qualified to do some of the jobs,
for example,
get them back here.
What jobs?
Mostly in manufacturing.
Okay.
These people that are looking for the service jobs that they've had for a number of years where the service sector's slowed way down.
Right.
You know, I don't have any details on this, but it's just the idea of giving people money to go seek jobs when they've proven that the jobs are not there.
Yeah. No, I don't disagree.
Jobs there.
My solution is not to extend unemployment benefits, but to put people to work and have the government be the employer of last resort. To say, you know, we've got bridges that need to be fixed. We've got houses that need to be winterized. We could put solar panels on everybody's roof. I mean, there's all kinds of things that we could do. Let's just put people to work, and they can get jobs. They can, you know, learn skills on the job, and that would get paychecks in their pockets, and that would cause them to be buying things in the economy, which would generate demand for other manufactured goods. And then if we just tweaked our trade policies so it's harder to import things from China and we start making things here, we would get our economy back. But that's just my theory. But Bill, thanks for a thought-provoking conversation and question. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be right back. Defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you, and Victor in Pittsburgh, Missouri. Hey, Victor, what's on your mind? Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Good afternoon, Tom. Thank you for the call, and happy New Year. I hope it's going to be a better year this year for change.
Yeah, well, I suspect it will be. I think the change is in the air, and it's an election year, so we can do something about it this year.
Yes, I hope so. The reason for my phone call, originally I was going to talk about unemployment, but I'm totally disabled, all right? And I've been hearing a lot of these conversations, and what that guy basically was speaking about is the right idea, the last caller.
Mm-hmm.
Is a great idea, I think. And because I've been through CETA program, JPTA, I went in the military, but I also turned down a good job before I went in the military because I decided to go in the military to serve my country. So I turned down a job at Wall Street in 1981. But
so you're suggesting that the job training is probably more important than job offer.
I think both things. What you were talking about as far as just putting it back to work.
Right.
I think they should get rid of the privatization portion and put people under government like what you were talking about, like what Roosevelt had.
Right.
And put them out around the highways and have them doing weatherization and doing CETA, actually doing CETA type work.
Yeah, that was Jimmy Carter's program. I was running a nonprofit at the time, the Salem Children's Village, and we had a CETA employee. That was I forget what CETA stood for. CETA. It was. Do you remember?
Yeah, it's community. It was for all nonprofit and local and state government type positions that they would fill in.
Right.
For lack of what?
Comprehensive Employment and Training Act, Shano tells me. And we had a fellow who came in who maintained the grounds the federal government paid, I think, all of his salary. And he ended up actually developing some good skills while he was working for us and got a job as the maintenance supervisor at a local school district after he left, which was a pretty good deal for him. I mean, he came in with no skills, you know, just a high school diploma, and he'd been unemployed for a couple of years. But that was Jimmy Carter's program. I think that died with Ronald Reagan, didn't it?
Right. What they did is they just changed the job partnership back to give to the businesses so they can cut 6 months and they can get half of their pay, so they have to pay only half the deal,
right?
You know, half their income.
Right. Yeah. So they screwed it up. Anyhow, Victor, thanks a lot for the call. Interesting ideas. James in Santa Fe Springs, California. Hey, James, what's on the air? Or what's on your mind? You want to talk about right wingers on the air?
Can you hear me?
I do hear you just fine.
Oh, okay. I don't know sometimes with these phones. Yeah, you know, one of the problems we have here in Santa Fe, well, here in Los Angeles area, we had a radio station, 1150, and you were on it one time. Mm-hmm. And just recently they changed the whole thing over to the right wingers. And what's happening is they're not only, Clear Channel owns it, not only are they on this station now, but there's another station at 640 that they're on there, AM, and we're just getting swamped with this right-wing nonsense.
Yeah.
And, you know, at one time they had, I think it was called the Fairness Doctrine,
mm-hmm.
but they eliminated it. Didn't Reagan eliminate that?
Reagan stopped enforcing it in 78, and President Obama did away with it last year. But it had not been enforced since 1978. But the Fairness Doctrine would not have required a radio station to play an hour of Rush Limbaugh and an hour of Tom Hartman. What the Fairness Doctrine required, although conservatives will tell you that all day long, it's not true. What the Fairness Doctrine required was that a station, in order to get their license renewed every year, had to demonstrate that they were programming in the public interest. And that did not mean right-wing talk radio, left-wing talk radio, country music, rock and roll, whatever. What it meant was that you had to have news at the top of every hour and that you had to have local news to prove that you were serving the local community. That's all gone. And you've got these big, you know, radio station chains now, and there was famously a couple of years ago, there was a city out somewhere in the Midwest where there was a train derailment. A chlorine car was leaking poison gas, and there were several radio stations in this town, and not a single one had an actual live local person on the air to warn people to evacuate the town. So, you know, I think that there's something to be said for returning to live and local programming and the Fairness Doctrine, and I realize I'm, you know, I'm a nationally syndicated host, but I still am a I started out in local radio, and I'm a fan of local radio. I think that, you know, it's an important thing. But I'll tell you, our show has been growing, and we've been growing by providing it to both for-profit radio stations and not-for-profit radio stations. So in Los Angeles, we're no longer on KTLK, but we're on KPFK, which is the largest radio station in the country. And it's a giant blowtorch FM signal there in Los Angeles, and as well as being on Free Speech TV, on the Dish Network, on DirecTV, on cable systems all over the country. And then also, you know, still on our commercial radio stations, which we value very, very highly. So I think that, and the other thing that I'm finding is, and I just saw these stats. In fact, there was a piece about it over at TV Newser yesterday that was repeated on Democratic Underground today, that Fox News and I think a lot of the right-wing radio, the listeners are just aging out. I mean, they're getting older and older and older. And younger and younger people are starting to listen on the internet. And I'm astounded just looking at my call volume. And of course, we also, you know, keep track of how many people are listening to our web stream because we have to pay for it. And, you know, it would have been 5 years ago, I might get one call a day from somebody listening on the internet. And now it's 20-30% of my calls. So a lot of younger people, and, you know, I mean, younger than 65, in many cases younger than 40, in many cases younger than 25 or 30, are getting their information no longer from radio stations. They're getting it on the internet. And a lot of radio stations are starting to then stream their signals on the web, you know, to satisfy that need, which is really interesting. So the whole industry is kind of up in the air. James, thanks for the call. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I guess the net of it all is, though, that, you know, don't mourn Progressive Talk Radio. We're doing just fine. Do that. Welcome back. Talk Radio for the sane among us. It's the Tom Hartman Program. It's Anything Goes Friday. And Janet in Topeka, Kansas, you are on the air, Janet.
Oh, hello, Tom. Read your book, Crash of 2016. Great book.
Oh, thank you.
But I had a question for Bernie, and I thought, you know, since it's anything goes, here goes.
Okay.
You know, he got a number of questions about TPP, that Trans-Pacific Partnership, that mm-hmm. Trade New Trade Agreement. my question, if he votes against it, does he take into account the financial services agreement, which is part of the TPP? That financial services agreement basically forces our trading partners, people who buy things from us or we buy things from them, that they, if, for instance, if we buy something from China, part of that agreement is they must then purchase some of these, what shall we call, toxic even financial services paper that's being traded.
In other words, the Chinese have to bail out our banks if we buy their toys?
Yep.
Well, you know, if that's good policy, I'm not sure that's good policy. I think basically we should just, you know, shut down our banks and break them up and fix them. But B, if that was good policy, it could be broken out from TPP. The TPP itself is altogether toxic. It is a giveaway of way too
agree.
Many things.
I agree, it is.
And Bernie will...
excuse
me. I couldn't even get to my sneeze button fast enough on that one. Bernie
sure.
will vote no on this. I mean, you know, he's unambiguous about that. So
The whole thing.
Yeah, the whole thing. The whole thing. So if there are pieces of the TPP that are you know, laudable... And in his opinion or in yours, they can be passed as separate pieces of legislation.
Oh, okay. Well, that was my question.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Janet. I appreciate the call. Eric in Cincinnati, Ohio. Hey, Eric, what's up?
Not much, Tom. Thanks. I just wanted to talk roughly about the whole idea of job creators.
Mm-hmm.
I find it funny that no one has brought up the idea that job creating is kind of a – the idea that anyone is a job creator other than demand on its own is crazy. I can give a company all the tax breaks in the world, all the way down to where they don't have to pay any taxes at all. If there's not more demand for the product, they're not going to produce more. If there's not going to produce more, they're not going to hire anybody to produce.
You're absolutely right. So in my mind, the real job creators are the people who spend 100% of their income. They create demand. The most demand. And so unemployed people, the people on welfare, oddly enough, because they're the real job creators. And of course, the working poor and the middle class who don't have large savings.
Right. The other piece to that is if there's a demand for something, I don't care if what you do. If there's money to be made and there's demand for it, someone will fill that role.
That's correct. Someone regardless of what the tax rates are.
Regardless if there's money to be made and there's a demand for that product, somebody is going to step in and do it. The idea that anyone is a job creator other than demand itself, demand is the real job creator. And the whole Reaganomics, trickle-down economics, is based on you can control an economy based on supply side. You can't.
That's correct.
Demand is what drives everything.
Yeah. Now the supply side people will tell you, and this is one of those great examples of how figures don't lie, but liars can figure, and how sometimes there's a grain of truth in a big lie. They will say, for example, before Steve Jobs and Apple invented the iPhone, there was no demand for smartphones. And so by creating a supply, they generated demand. And there is a certain amount of truth to the fact that innovation creates demand. But that doesn't, that is so secondary to genuine, to people having money in their pocket that they want to buy things with, to genuine demand causing people to produce, to offer supply, that it's really the exception that proves the rule rather than the proof of, that's what supply-siders will say to you. Is they'll say, well, here's proof that you create supply and it'll create demand. And go ahead.
The only thing that really proves is that we should dump more money into NASA, because quite frankly, most of the innovations, a lot of the past four decades, have really come out of NASA
come
and
out
a
of
lot
the space
of other
program.
Things. So the money,
you're right. DARPANET, the internet,
investing money into private organizations to do research, that's what created all that.
Yeah, and universities. And, you're absolutely right, Eric. That's a very, very good point. Thanks a lot for the call. Good one. Fred in Sheldon, Vermont. Hey, Fred, what's on your mind? Medical marijuana?
Yeah, well, before I even ask you the question, I got your book, The Crash of 2016, for Christmas, and so far I love it. It's phenomenal.
Well, thank you. A lot of work went into that book.
I turned some other people onto it, and they've ordered it, so they're going to give me some feedback on what they think about my recommendation. And my question is, many years ago, I used to have bouts of depression on and off, and I would smoke some marijuana very sparingly for some relief. This is long before pharmaceuticals were making, all these different pills they make now.
Right.
Then I stopped doing it because I just got tired of the whole routine of trying to get some bit from people.
Tracking down a drug dealer. Yeah.
Basically, I mean, I tried to deal with people who worked and weren't shady people, but they just used it for their own reasons as well. So fast forward to lately, they've discovered, well, this is great. We can give out medical marijuana to people who have cancer and rheumatoid arthritis and whatnot. And now they want to say, okay, let's just legalize it completely. Well, I wouldn't mind having my doctor prescribe me some I've gotten really depressed. None of the pills have worked. I've tried 15 types of different antidepressants. I've been through intense therapy programs, but I don't want to submit myself to going out. I'm, you know, almost 60 years old, knocking at some college student's dorm door asking, "You got any?" Or
yeah.
You understand where I'm coming from?
Oh, I do. I absolutely do. And wouldn't it be nice?
I don't understand. I guess I don't know if you know the answer to this. I'd just like to see what your opinion is. I've spoken with my psychiatrist, and she said, "I'd love to be able to prescribe you some for what's going on with your problems, but I can't."
Right. And this is a drug that you have used in the past that has actually worked for your depression.
Yeah, it doesn't make me high. It doesn't give me the munchies. It just makes my depression lift. I didn't abuse it. I was grateful to be able to get someone I could, but yeah. There were times I couldn't get any, so I weathered the storm. So I'm thinking, gee, if I could get it prescribed.
Is medical marijuana not legal in Vermont yet?
It is legal, but it's only legal if you have cancer because of the nausea. And my problem with it is what's going on here? It's going to go from a select few that have some problems medically, you know, and to legalizing it like you could buy a six-pack of beer or something.
Yeah, I think we're going to see. I think we're going to see this thing open up a lot, Fred. I think that the states that have medical marijuana and highly restrict it to people, you know, who have glaucoma and are going through chemo and things like that, are going to start loosening up those restrictions and just basically saying, if your doctor thinks it's good for you, you can get it, which is more or less how they've done it in California and how they were doing it in Colorado. And increasingly you're going to see states. I think this is going to be like the end of prohibition. I predict within 2 years, you as a medical marijuana user will be able to easily get it in Vermont or in a nearby state. And within 5 years, pretty much anybody in the country will be able to get it as a recreational drug, as a replacement for beer and wine and hard liquors. And that will save 50,000 people a year who die from cirrhosis and you know, alcohol overdoses and alcohol damage to their bodies. And so, I'm of the opinion that, you know, what Colorado is doing right now is a great noble experiment. And you know, this stuff wasn't even illegal until the 1920s. So we had the entire, the founders never thought that we had, and in fact, none of these drugs were illegal. And there was cocaine and there was opium, and they called it laudanum. And, you could buy it in the pharmacy, in your drugstore over the counter. You could get cocaine over the counter. You could get marijuana over the counter. During the time of Jefferson and Washington and all these guys. And I mean, you know, it was low potency. It was the kind of basically the original plants. And Lydia Pinkham's tonic was, you know, used by women throughout most of the 1900s. The 19th century. And you know, and it was a lot of these. There were very different, varied formulas. I just think the whole thing, this whole criminalization of drugs is nuts. That A, if you can grow something in your backyard, you should be able to grow it, whatever it is. And it, you know, although I do have a problem with people making synthetic things in a lab, and B, this is it for those people for whom it's a problem. It's a medical problem. Hang on.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It's a medical problem, not a criminal problem, and it needs to be moved entirely out of the criminal justice system and entirely into our healthcare system. Fred, thank you for the call. Welcome back. Robert in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Robert, what's up?
Hi, second time I've had a chance to call you. I'm glad to talk to you again.
Thank you.
I had an idea about unemployment and the way that we're handling it now. We used to have, you know, offices in every city where you go to the unemployment office and all that, and they would carry the database of what they knew was available in the local area.
Mm-hmm.
What if the federal government kept a database of all jobs opening up everywhere in the economy? You could find where they might be, and they could let you know if maybe there's a job 50 miles away from you or wherever, and help you actually apply for it, interview for it, and if you get it, get you there and get you placed. Companies do that all the time for people.
Yeah, and there are some agencies that work with people who are long-term unemployed, who help them, who teach them, some of them are charities and some of them are actually funded with federal and state block grants. A friend of mine runs the Central Vermont, I'm forgetting the name of the agency, but it's a big agency that, you know, helps poor people in Central Vermont. And they actually train people on how to get a job. You know, here's how you interview for a job. Here's what's expected of you. Here's how you behave on a job. You know, for people who are just getting into the job market or who have been out of the market for a long, long time.
Yeah, but what about people that are laid off from auto or whatever now and they need retraining or whatever? They know how to look to get a job.
Yeah.
They just can't find the jobs because they're not there right now or in their area.
Right.
And we don't do much for them. We don't have apprenticeships programs. We don't have the government stabilize and centralize this stuff so that we don't duplicate efforts.
Well, and you know, it wasn't everywhere. So much the government that used to do that, Robert. It was the unions.
Yeah.
You know, before Reagan, you had a third of America was working a union job, and with
I was one of them.
Okay, and with a union job, one person could raise a family. And,
I know.
And the unions ran the apprenticeship programs, and the unions helped people, you know, into the job market, Ronald Reagan declared war on unions in 1981 when he busted PATCO, and, you know, one of the very first things he did as president after they had endorsed him in his run for president,
right,
after he had promised them that he would allow them to strike. And then when they struck, he busted them. It was like that should have told us everything we needed to know about the Reagan presidency, that he betrayed, you know, one of his first acts of office was to betray the people who had supported him and that he had lied to them. And, you know, he declared a war on unions, and we've gone from about a third of America's workforce being unionized to 6% of the private workforce being unionized. And the only, you know, the largest chunk of the workforce now that's in one continuous block that's still unionized are federal government workers or our government workers. And you've got every single state that's run by a Republican now trying to take them apart. They've laid off 700,000 government workers in the last 5 years.
Well, of course.
And the reason why they're trying to screw the post office is not because they have some hatred of people getting mail, but because it's the largest unionized employer in the United States. It's the second largest employer in the United States behind Walmart, and it's the largest unionized employer in the United States. So hey, let's bust this sucker up. And
oh, yeah, it's class warfare.
It is. It absolutely is class warfare, and it's all about taking down the middle class and replacing it with a very compliant class of the working poor who will just say yes sir, you know, may I get your coffee, sir, or whatever, and you know, on it goes. So anyhow, we could commiserate about this for a long, long time, Robert, but we've run out of time. Thank you for the call, though, and a great conversation starter. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. We'll be back 10 minutes before you go. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Let's check in with Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service for talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com, where you can give the gift of a goat to a returning slave in South Sudan at goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Victoria, hello. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, yes.
It's very nice to see you. So what's up?
Oh, there's plenty up, and it's only day three.
Indeed. Of the election year.
Of the election year. We're not even going to utter those words yet.
Okay. All right.
But
you know that.
Ringing.
Yeah, you know that to use that hand gesture, the election year, those are the strings that are pulling all the puppets that are running around this city, you know.
They're pulling the puppets, and it's hanging like a smog-like Beijing pall over everything.
You are so poetic. So let's give me some examples.
The Obama administration told the Supreme Court today that a group of Colorado nuns, Little Sisters of the Poor, does not need a special injunction against the new health care law provision that provides contraceptive coverage for employees, because the group could easily exempt itself from the requirement. And so the government asked Justice Sonia Sotomayor to lift the temporary injunction that she issued on New Year's Eve.
So, this is something that I think most people misunderstand. Sonia Sotomayor did not say Well, let me rephrase this. This was not about whether or not the nuns had to have birth control included in their health care. The Obamacare says you don't have to. But if
Correct.
You want to claim that you are a religious organization and therefore exempt from that requirement and therefore qualify for a health insurance policy that doesn't include birth control, you have to fill out a form. The nuns objected to filling out the form, period. And that was the injunction, was that they shouldn't have to fill out the form. Do I have that right?
Right. It's a self-certification letter.
Yes.
And they say that that basically violates their religious freedom. They contend that if they sign these self-certification letters, it makes them complicit in the government's plan to provide contraception
to other people.
The law provides that third-party insurers still provide the coverage.
Right, and that's sort of like the argument that war protesters made, you know, back 2-3 decades ago of, I'm not paying any of my federal taxes because some of it's going to drop bombs on Vietnam. Yeah, that's true, but, you know, it's not going to probably wash when it gets to court.
It's interesting. Now, the Solicitor General, this is when it really gets into the weeds, so I'm not even going to go into the details because I get very lost because the ERISA law comes into play.
Mm-hmm.
But the Solicitor General says the Little Sisters case is a weak test case because their third-party insurer is covered by the ERISA law. It's a church plan that the government contends can't be required to provide contraceptive services anyway.
Uh-huh.
And so that's a second problem.
So they almost don't even have standing here.
That's, I think, something that the government is going to contend. So this is going to be interesting. So Sotomayor can basically say that this they say missed it, or say, you know, sorry, I'm not doing this myself. Hey, guys, come back from your break.
Yeah, there you go. Okay. What else is up?
Any of those things. Well, interesting. The White House today proposed two new federal rules that it said would provide more information about the mentally ill to gun background check databases.
Two new rules?
Rules, yes, rules, not laws, rules. They're proposed by Justice and the Health and Human Services Departments, and they would allow the federal database access to some mental health records.
Oh, interesting.
By giving it an exemption from existing privacy law, and would clarify that people involuntarily committed to both inpatient and outpatient institutions could be prohibited from purchasing guns.
So this is the Obama administration doing by administrative fiat what the majority of Americans want done, which is no more guns in the hands of crazy people. However, it leaves intact the gun show loophole and things like that. So it's not going the whole way.
It's not going the whole way, and it can't go the whole way,
right.
Basically. Yeah,
that does require legislation.
Right, it does require legislation. It's another of the executive actions in the wake of the Sandy Hook massacre.
Right, so this is the president keeping his word that he was going to do something, damn it. He did it today.
It is.
Yeah.
Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke gave a parting shot today at Washington's fiscal policy. He's given a few zingers to Congress. Of course, his zingers are so dry that they're more dry than English wit. You really don't know that you've been zinged until he's left the room.
So they're completely lost on the members of Congress. Now, he's no longer the Fed chairman, right?
Well, he is until the end of this month.
Uh-huh. Okay, thank you. Thank you for that.
And the vote on Janet Yellen is scheduled for Monday, by the
right.
way.
Right, okay.
To replace him.
Okay.
No, I think you're right. I think he's out. Well, I'm a bit confused.
Yeah, no, it may well be the end of the month. I honestly don't know.
I think it's the end of the month.
Yeah.
Anyway, so he said to the American Economic Association, excessively tight near-term fiscal policies have likely been counterproductive.
In other words, austerity is killing the economy.
I think that's what he was saying.
Yes. Yes.
And then he said this, with fiscal and monetary policy working in opposite directions, the recovery is weaker than it otherwise would be.
Right. In other words, we, the Fed, with monetary policy, we're trying to stimulate the economy, but you, Congress, the Republicans, with your austerity and your sequester, you're killing the economy, and between the two of us, we're not able to get much done.
You're killing us here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Somebody needs to give him a course in basic English 101.
Yes, or like public speaking or...
Oh, you know, like that old Saturday Night Live thing, news for the hearing impaired, where in the corner the guy is shouting, you know, the reporter would say, and here's the news, and then in the corner the guy would go, and here's the news!
Yes.
And but it should be, you know, Bernanke speaks, and he says, and this is Dozen City, and then somebody in the corner would be shouting, and you're screwing up the economy! Right? He needs an interpreter, right? Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, Talk Radio News, brought to you by GhostsForTheOldGoat.com. Thank you, Victoria. Happy New Year.
Thank you, and to you too.
Thank you. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 6 minutes past the hour. It's Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program. And Frank in DeSoto, Texas. Hey, Frank, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I'm so glad to talk to you. I love your book. But, you know, I'm really concerned as an African-American that when you talked about the decline of unions, which is a real thing, and how wages have been stagnant for so many years for American workers, you refuse to point out that the influx of immigrant workers and their preference for vulnerable immigrant workers by employees is another reason for the wage depression, and also the wage substitution for black workers, which the National Wage Council points out is in direct competition with many of the immigrant workers.
Yeah, I think
talking agriculture, we're talking construction, we're talking light manufacturing, and we're talking services.
And meatpacking. And you're right. And in fact, there's an entire chapter about that in my book, Rebooting the American Dream. I think you're probably right, though, that's not in the crash of 2016. That book, when the editors were done with it, came out at about 80,000 words, and I had written over 120,000.
No, I'm not being critical of the book, Tom.
Yeah.
The book is fine. I'm talking about when you talk today about unions.
Unions have there's a bit of a checkered past here, Frank. I mean, you know, in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and arguably even in through the 60s, unions were actively working to keep workplaces segregated. You know, they were keeping African Americans out of the workplace, and then unions started becoming an agent of integration, particularly, you know, coming out of Detroit. I mean, I grew up in Lansing. I could see this happening around me. You know, some unions and other unions were still, you know, very, very much into the whole segregation thing. But now I think unions have become very, very progressive, but they're dying.
But look at how unions welcomed immigrants. For the first time, they've moved on the side of immigrants for many of these jobs, while American workers, you know, with 22 million that are seeking full-time jobs, 11 million, three American workers for every job that's opening, there's not the focus on our own. We're the only country in the world that gives immigrant workers who are more vulnerable and more desired by employers great advantages over our own workers.
And one of the things you've identified, Frank, is a fault line within the union movement and an area of great dispute and disagreement within the union movement or at least it was a couple of years ago. I think increasingly now the unions, you know, they're trying to organize the low wage sectors, and the low wage sectors, like, you know, maids in hotels and people who work in the kitchens and the restaurants and things, and a lot of them are immigrants. And so in the course of trying to unionize those folks, they're embracing, you know, comprehensive immigration reform. But that said, there is a combination of factors that have, you know, that combine to have destroyed not only the white middle class, but over the years have prevented really a large creation of the black middle class. I'd say that, you know, Lyndon Johnson really gave a help to the creation of the black middle class, but that pushed back against that. And those are our trade policies and our immigration policies. And, you know, we had the Bracero program in the United States in the 60s, 50s, 60s, and I think the early 70s, where people could come north during the summer during the summer and fall, and then they had to go south. But that was just this, you know, incredibly exploitative, racist program. And then, you know, when Reagan decriminalized or legalized or whatever, gave amnesty to 5 or 6 million people who were in this country illegally, he stopped enforcing the employer sanctions. And this is the real big issue, and I've talked about this many, many times on the air, Frank, is that we don't have an illegal immigrant problem in this country. We have an illegal employer problem in this country. Prior to the Reagan administration, the largely wealthy white guys who ran the meatpacking plants, who were the house builders, who ran the construction operations and were the contractors and whatnot, they hired union workers and they hired Americans because they knew that if they were hiring people who were not citizens of the United States, they themselves could go to jail, and they did. Reagan put a stop to that in 1986. He stopped enforcing the laws against the wealthy white employers and basically said, you know, you guys can hire anybody you want. And over the next two decades, what you saw was the meatpacking industry, which used to, you know, pay really good wages. People, you could, as a meatpacker, you could make good living. That has gone, you know, completely kaplooey. The construction trades, one of my brothers is an electrician and a roofer, and I've watched the construction trades. You know, it's just gone to hell as a result of basically the contractors being able to hire people who are not citizens. And you're exactly right. They're hiring people who they can exploit. They can threaten. They can say, I told you I'll pay you $5 an hour, but I'm only going to give you $4. What are you going to do? Complain about it? If you do, I'll call ICE. You know, that kind of thing. And so we really have to look at this in a little more holistic way, if that makes sense.
Thanks so much, Tom.
Thank you, Frank. Thank you. It's an important topic. It really is. Chase in Asheville, North Carolina. Hey, Chase. Thanks for calling.
Hey, how are you, Tom?
I'm well. What's on your mind?
Yes, I was calling because I genuinely want your opinion on something I've been tinkering with. The other night I watched Oliver Stone's Platoon for the first time, and it caused me to evaluate the practicality of requiring military service.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know too much about your stance on the issue. However, pretending that military service became mandated in order to combat inequality, do you think a new framework would simply place marginalized groups at the front lines and non-marginalized groups in cushy military jobs? And if so, how could this issue be addressed?
Sure. I've never seen Platoon. I just those movies are too intense for me, so I can't speak to that. But I did live through the Vietnam era and through the time when there was a draft, and had friends who were drafted and never came back. You know, they came back in boxes. And I am strongly of the opinion that if we are going to engage in military adventures abroad, and we have been doing this, the only president that hasn't started a war during his presidency in my lifetime is Jimmy Carter. If we're going to continue doing this, then we must have a draft. Everybody should have some skin in the game, including every member of Congress. And the way that I would organize it is, I would say that every person, when they graduate from high school, or at least every young man, but I think, you know, we might want to extend this to women as well, should commit at least 1 year of service to their country. They could either do it in the military or they could do it in the nonprofit sector. They could work in a hospital or any other nonprofit organization for a year. And then at the end of that year, having given a year to their country will give them, you know, up to 4 years of free trade school or free college. And I think that this fulfills the biological and psychological imperative of a rite of passage into adulthood. I think that this gets people out of their comfort zones and out of their homes and out of their communities, and they get to see the world and get to see the rest of the country. I think it causes all of us to feel like, you know, if we're going to declare a war, it's all of us. It's not just the poor. Because with an all-volunteer army, what you get a few people in the military who are just, you know, gung-ho. They're, you know, military families 5 generations back, and they love it. And you get a lot of people who are there because they're desperately poor and it's the only job they could get. Am I making sense?
That is. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chase. And Thomas Jefferson proposed something very much like this. In fact, you can probably Google and find the article I wrote about it. Charlie Rangel and I have had several long conversations about this on the air. He served during the Korean War and decorated combat veteran. And he agrees with me on this totally. But Thomas Jefferson said, "I hope I shall never live to see the day when a young man in my country shall be willing to be shot at for a sixpence." And because he thought everybody should be part of the militia.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And this was the Second Amendment, that everybody would be a member of a militia between 17 and 47 years of age, and there would be no standing army during a time of peace. And welcome back. Let's pick up a Free Speech TV call here. Diane in Lansing, Michigan, my hometown. Hey, Diane, what's up?
Hi, Tom. That's my reason for calling, because I thought you'd be interested to find out what our legislature's doing.
Oh, no. I hear stories. I have 3 brothers who live there. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're costing us $600 million over the next 3 months, which works out to $7 million a day.
Wow.
Because they didn't expand the Medicaid expansion until April 1st.
But they're going to do it on April 1st? They're going to take the federal money?
Yes, but it's going to cost us the taxpayers $600 million for over those 3 months because they didn't do it on January 1st.
So the state is expanding it effective today, but the state is going to pick up the tab until April 1st?
Yes.
That's very interesting because the legislature screwed up because they didn't pass it in time.
Exactly.
Amazing.
So there is a website that everybody can go to let the legislators, and they've got their pictures up. Each one of them is a Republican.
Yeah. Surprise, surprise.
Yeah. And you can let them know how you feel about that. It's $7MillionDaysDays.com.
$7MillionDaysDays.com. Is 7 spelled out or is it the digit?
No, it's just number 7 and then $MillionDaysDays.com.
Days plural.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the number 7MillionDaysDays.com, and this is principally for Michigan residents or for anybody in the country who wants to just say something to the Michigan legislature?
Well, it's pretty much for everybody. The Democrats put it together. I got the email from my senator, Gretchen Whitmer, about it.
Who's a Democrat?
Yesterday.
Yeah.
Yes. Yep.
Yeah.
So,
That's fascinating.
And these people are supposed to be fiscally responsible, and...
Yeah. You know, it's so weird because I grew up in Michigan and I had a friend who was a member of the Michigan legislature when I was in college, and he was in his 20s and he was a state representative from Eaton Rapids, and he was one of the youngest guys in the House of Representatives, and he was a Republican, and he was very progressive. I mean, this was, you know, the late 60s, and it was possible for a Republican to be progressive even then and get elected. And it's just, it's like the... You know, it's not just the state went to hell in a handbasket. The party did too. I mean, it's just.
Well, Rick Snyder was pushing for it to be expanded, but they vetoed him and went ahead and delayed it. So that's why it's costing us so much money right now.
Wow. So Snyder originally wanted to do like Jan Brewer and just say, okay, we'll take it.
Yes, he did. Yep. I was shocked by that, but yes, he did.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, at a certain point, you look out and you do the math and you say, you know, people are going to figure out that this is the best thing. And especially in a state that has as high an unemployment level as Detroit, as Michigan does, you know, with the problems of Detroit and and everything else. I mean, it's just.
And I was reading in the newspaper today that apparently we're going to have a surplus of $433.5 million, but it sounds like most of that's just going to go to pay this.
Yes. Incredible. $7MillionDaysCom, the website. Diane, thank you for the call, and thanks for the report from Lansing.
You're welcome.
It's great to hear from you. Say hi to everybody there for me. 20 minutes past the hour. We'll be back. Oh, Mark Taylor Canfield has some comments for us about the differences between cannabis legality between Washington and Colorado State. I want to hear that. We'll pick that up right after the break and more of your calls as well. Past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Mark Taylor Canfield on the line, a reporter, indie reporter out of Seattle, writes for the Huffington Post and other places. Hey, Mark.
Hey, Happy New Year, Tom, to you, your family, and all of your audience.
Well, thank you. And the same to you and yours. And it says here you wanted to talk about the differences in cannabis legality between Washington State and Colorado State. Colorado is getting a lot of publicity. I think everybody's kind of figured out that you can just basically show up and buy a relatively small amount, but you can show up and buy some pot and you can grow six plants and all that kind of thing. How are they doing it in Washington?
Well, you know, I help moderate a weekly national press briefing, and there are two big stories, one of which you covered on your other program, which is the $15 an hour minimum wage proposition. Being
right.
Set aside by a Superior Court Judge, Andrea Dravis. So that's been or Darvis, actually. That's a King County Superior Court Judge, Andrea Darvis.
Right, so the people at the SeaTac Airport are not getting the wage increase that the citizens of SeaTac voted for them, because this judge says the SeaTac Airport is actually not part of the city of SeaTac. It's actually run by the Seattle Port Authority, so it's under the control of Seattle.
Correct, and that's been a big disappointment for a lot of the union organizers and the folks behind
Proposition. Well, it ain't over yet, Mark.
Measure.
I mean, this is going to be appealed. So,
exactly.
And then the second is marijuana got decriminalized in Washington State. One of my kids is moving actually next week to Washington State. Lives in Portland right now in Oregon. Tell me what's going on there.
Well, it's a very confusing situation, Tom. It's difficult for journalists to cover the story because we have a very ironic situation where, as of December 6th of last year, the voters approved an initiative to make the recreational use and possession of 1 ounce or less of marijuana legal in Washington State. The difficulty here is that the initiative was so open-ended that it left a lot of the details about the regulation of the distribution, sale, and growing of marijuana unwritten. And as of today, I am still living in a state where it's legal to have an ounce of marijuana, but it's not necessarily legal to sell or distribute it. And unless you're a registered marijuana patient, nor is it necessarily legal to grow it. So it's very confusing for people here. And the problem there is that I believe it was a political decision by the people who ran the initiative to try to keep it as open-ended as possible, with this promise that the details would be worked out later. But all of the regulation for marijuana in Washington State was turned over to Washington State Liquor Board, which up until last year had no experience or knowledge really of how marijuana is used in the state. So they've literally had to hire former growers and users to help them understand the product. They have to figure out how to market it at a price which will be competitive. They have to figure out how to regulate things like the public use of marijuana, because one of the ideas behind the initiative is, let's make marijuana like alcohol,
right,
where it's regulated. There are places you can get it. There will be dispensaries in Washington State. But the question was, what do we do about all of these other issues?
So did the initiative give the power to the liquor board to come up with the regulations, and they just haven't gotten to it yet? Is that the deal? Or did it give it to the legislature? The legislature has refused to act.
No, it's actually the state is watching Colorado right now. And I know they've already admitted that there are flights going back and forth between Washington State and Colorado. They're trying to figure out, how is Colorado doing it?
right.
doing it, and how will that work for Washington State? But the initiative did not have any of those details worked out. It was left up to the liquor board
right.
to decide how
so
to
So they may well end up just cloning what, you know, whatever they do in Colorado, that's what we do here. That's the rules. You think?
One of the new ideas is that there is a resolution for a city ordinance that passed through committee for Seattle, which would be a $30 fine for anyone caught smoking in public. So that's one way that they're trying to regulate it. But it's very confusing because people, I think, in Seattle are used to smoking pot outdoors. In fact, the city gave a permit for a huge smokeout on December 6th of 2013. And, you know, 500 people showed up and were smoking marijuana. So
right.
it's a very confusing situation for folks. You know, and I feel sorry for your son in a way because it is going to be difficult to figure out how all of this regulation is going to work. There are DUI laws now where if you are suspected of being under the influence of marijuana, you can be fined and have your license taken just like alcohol.
Yeah.
The testing on that is very controversial. So I expect a lot of court challenges on that as well.
Well, but feel sorry for his friends. I should not have mentioned one of my kids is moving to Washington State, and because I don't want to personalize this. And for the record, I'm pretty sure that child of mine this is not an issue that he's concerned with. But nonetheless, it's an issue that the state is concerned with and is really going to have to do something about. I mean, you know, what are they going to do?
Yeah, just as a citizen of the state, it's difficult to figure out what the laws actually are because, you know, maybe the city of Seattle might pass a $30 fine, but maybe Spokane will, you know, pass a $100 fine. It's just a very confusing situation for a lot of people, especially for medicinal marijuana users, because there was an attempt last year to actually dismantle the entire medicinal marijuana program under this logic that, well, if it's legal, then we don't need to do that. But the problem is that there are already dispensaries in Washington State which have
right.
servicing marijuana.
Well, in Colorado, they're using that dispensary infrastructure to sell to the general public.
Right, and as of today in Washington State, that's not happening. The only way to actually buy marijuana from a dispensary is if you're registered with the state as a marijuana patient.
Right.
The general public does not have that option yet. They're still trying to work all of these issues out. And I just wanted to let the country know that although, you know, there were the BBC and the CDC and all of Reuters and everyone was here on December 6th to cover this big pot smoke out, the details have not been worked out. And Colorado actually is quite a ways ahead of us right now, Tom. They worked out a lot of
it. They've got this thing nailed down. They've got it nailed down. And the state is going to be making some serious money off it, too. And I think it's going to go like lotteries. You're going to see this thing just spread across the country. Mark Taylor Canfield, always great talking with you, Mark.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
We'll see how this works out, and where it works out, and what happens. If you have any thoughts on it, feel free to reach out. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And I'm going to get back to your calls in just a second, but I just had to tell you a funny story. Last night, it got so cold here in Washington, D.C., and Louise and I live on this 30-year-old boat, right, in the low-rent public marina here in town. And yeah, it's not – I don't mean to say that we're – impoverished. But it's in any case, it's we're having, you know, we like it. We like it a lot. But it's there's two ways that these boats heat themselves and cool themselves. One is you cycle water through them. It's a heat pump basically. But when the water in the river gets cold enough, you can't draw heat out of it anymore, and then you have to go to electric heaters. And so now the entire boat is being heated with electric heaters, which is not real efficient, and you get hot spots and cold spots. But the interesting thing was that there are these things called fenders, which are these round rubber things. They're about 3 feet long and about 8 inches in diameter, and they're filled with air, and they're thick rubber. And you hang them off the side of the boat between the boat and the dock that you're tied up to, and the boat bounces off them on the dock so that you don't injure the boat or the dock. And last night it got so cold that the fenders froze, and so instead of this normal kind of soft bounce sound that I would hear all night long as the boat bounces against the dock. It sounded like clunks of wood, you know, hitting the boat. In fact, I got up in the middle of the night. I thought, you know, maybe there's like, you know, somebody's boat came apart or something, or there's a boat. It was just bang, 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 bang. And I went out and I finally figured out that the fenders had frozen hard, and so they were banging hard into the side of the boat because it was like, you know, 17 degrees last night. So there was nothing I could do about it, so I went back to bed. And all night long I had these wild dreams about, you know, the boat next to me had gotten loose and I was out hauling this. And then another dream, we were, you know, washing up on a desert island or something, and there were all these people that it was just, I mean, just the weirdest, wildest dreams that had to do with these boat noises. Because and there was high winds. We had 50-mile-an-hour winds last night, and which caused the water to splash against the side of the boat. And I'm like sleeping, like, you know, there's me and there's the wall and there's the water, and so I'm hearing the bang, 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 and I'm hearing the splash, 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 which I normally, you know, normally you don't have 50-mile-an-hour winds. And so it was a very, very, if I'm a little odd today, you know, first of all, Louise and I just kept waking each other up all night long. I gotta tell you about the dream I just had. Or what's that noise? You know, that's where it started around 1 o'clock in the morning when the wind really started to pick up and it got really cold. It was, what's that noise? Is that somebody kicking the side of our boat? Is that, you know, did the line get loose? Are we floating out in the harbor? And, you know, and I haven't started the motors on this thing in a year and I don't have a license to do it anyway. It's one of my projects for one of these summers. And so I thought, oh my God, you know, if we've gotten loose, I mean, I'm in big trouble. And so, anyhow, it was a wild night. So, the other story that I wanted to tell you, these are the things people ask me about, and, you know, from time to time, I go out and do book signings and things, and, you know, why don't you tell us about your life a little more? Okay, here's, you know, so I did. I am. And the other is, you know, we had Higgins, and then we have Fang, who is the rescue cat that my brother and his wife rescued that we ended up with, and who's now turned into a roly-poly little gray tabby. And we got Mowgli, who was also a rescue cat who was feral and is still so feral that maybe one day a week he'll let me touch him, but mostly he just kind of hides. And so, you know, and Higgins died a couple weeks ago or months ago, and a week or two after Higgins died, Louise got a new kitten named Wolfie, who looks like a wolf. This little gray tabby thing, and he's part Pixie Bob, but he's not a full breed kind of thing. He doesn't have the short tail and all that kind of stuff. But he's going to be a big cat. But he looks like a wolf. He's got this little gray face, and he's now when he first arrived, he was the size of, you know, he would fit in your one hand. Now he's two hands worth. And it's just been a couple of weeks, so he's growing like a weed. So and he's turned into Mr. Social. So, you know, Fang just basically wants to eat and sleep, and Mowgli wants to hide. But Wolfie wants to play and hang out, which is really kind of cool. So we're having a good time. So that's what's going on in my life. Tim in Jacksonville, Florida. Hey, Tim, you wanted to talk about Jeb Bush?
Yeah, I got a question about Jeb Bush. First, I'd like to say thank you very much for all you do, and Happy New Year, and welcome back for another season.
Thank you.
And my question is, I have heard for years that Jeb went to his daddy when he was in the White House and asked him to pardon a Cuban terrorist because it would help him in the gubernatorial in Florida, and I wondered if that was true and what the details were.
My recollection, which may be wrong, so don't take this as fact, but my recollection is, and I used to know the guy's name, is that there was a right-wing white Cuban who blew up a Cuban airliner when Castro was running the country. Orlando Bosch, yeah, that was his name.
Orlando Bosch, that is correct.
And like 70, 80 people died when he blew up that airliner, and he was arrested.
How many of those people were American?
I don't remember. I'm not sure that any of them were, but I just don't know. And he was sent to jail, and I know that he was freed, and he was running around loose in Cuba during the Bush presidency. Whether that was because he had served his sentence or whether that was because George had pardoned him, I frankly don't remember. But I remember Orlando Bosch, and I remember that story.
I guess my question is, how can Jeb Bush possibly run for president if he has petitioned to have a terrorist pardoned who killed Americans?
Well, this was a right-wing terrorist. You've got to understand. You know, Peter King, the congressman from New York State, the Republican, the one who famously told, in fact, I've got it on my computer here, Pelosi's daughter. Let me just play this for you if I can open it. But Peter King. PQR Peter King. Here it is, right here. I got it. Peter King, the night of the John Kerry election, or just before that, Nancy Pelosi's daughter was doing a documentary on the election of 2004. And before the election was over, I mean, before the ballots were even cast, I think, Peter King was drunk at a party with George W. Bush, and he said this on camera.
It's already over. The election's over. We won.
How do you know that?
It's all over but the county. We'll take care of the county.
It's all over but the county, and we'll take care of the county. Peter King, who is the darling of the right wing, Peter King, who is going after right now anybody who he's going after Obama for trying to negotiate with the Iranians. Peter King was a big supporter of the IRA. He supported right-wing terrorists who actually killed people in Northern Ireland and in London, supported them aggressively. So the Republicans don't have a problem with supporting terrorists as long as they're your terrorists. I mean, Reagan was supporting the death squads in El Salvador and the death squads in Nicaragua, you know, who were killing the Sandinistas. That was part of Iran-Contra was all about that. So I think, you know, Jeb Bush's support of a right wing Cuban terrorist probably will help him with the Republican Party rather than hurt him, assuming that that's the case.
Whenever we hear the right wing saying do not negotiate with terrorists, I think about is Reagan in Iran, and I think about Jeb Bush and this guy.
Yeah. Yeah, and then there's a whole lot of other examples. But, yeah, I'm with you. Tim, thanks a lot for the call. Howard in Hollywood, Florida. Hey, Howard, what's up?
How you doing, Tom?
Good.
I've got to take exception to your saying Reagan did not have a CETA.
Oh, really?
Yes. He had a create entitlements to the aristocracy program.
Oh, create entitlements to the aristocracy. I like that. That's great. Okay, thank you, Howard.
Couple other points, if I may.
Yes. You're the master of the acronym here. You've won a minute or two. Go for it. Actually, one minute. I just got the 1 minute cue from Shane. So,
in terms of Snowden,
mm-hmm.
he said he went to superiors to give this information to them, and they refused to do anything with it.
Yes, on two occasions he said he did that. Yeah.
That takes the argument away from Obama that he didn't try to do it the right way.
Well, he worked for a private contractor. You know, he worked for Booz Allen Hamilton that was owned by the Carlyle Group, which was owned by the Bin Laden family. So he, you know, and Obama's whistleblower protection that he signed does not extend to private corporations. So.
No, but the point is the principle that he tried to do it the right way.
Oh, yeah. I agree with you.
And then the other thing is, why are we not doing an investigation on Ed Meese and the government shutdown? If Daryl Issa had this on the Democrats, it would be all over the place.
Oh, yeah. You know, you're talking about the group of Republicans that Ed Meese pulled together to organize the shutdown that happened 2 months ago.
Why aren't we doing that?
Yeah. If I were Harry Reid, I would be talking with some of the chair people of some of the committees in the Senate and saying, let's do some serious investigations into a number of things. Let's look into Ed Meese. Let's look into the Newt Gingrich one back, you know, in January 20th of 2009, or excuse me, of 2001. I mean, there's, you know, 2009. There's a whole bunch of them that I think they should be looking at.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And then the one today, I mean, Bernie Sanders just submitted a letter to the NSA saying, are you guys listening to senators, by the way? And he hasn't gotten an answer yet, to the best of my knowledge. I think there's a whole bunch of things that should be helped. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And let's see. Chris, listening to KBAI in Bellingham, Washington. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Fine. What's on your mind?
Hey, I'm a big fan of your program. I just wanted to talk a little bit about the machinists and Boeing contract vote that's happening today.
Oh, the vote is happening today? How did I miss that?
Yes, it is. Yes. And, you know, I think it's not only a big deal for Washington State. I think it's a big deal for the labor movement in general.
Right. Well, this is basically a rollover or get squashed kind of situation. I mean, the union is in a real, you know, lose or lose badly situation, are they not?
That's correct. And you have Democratic politicians lining up, wringing their hands, urging them to vote yes.
Yeah,
there's
keep the jobs in the state.
On the radio and TV, urging the machinists to vote yes.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like hopefully they have enough cojones to say no.
Because, well, if they do, they will be out of work because Boeing is, you know, corporations are sociopaths by definition virtually, and Boeing will move those jobs. I mean, the governor of Missouri has raised $1.7 billion to put into Boeing's fat little pockets if they will simply move those jobs to Missouri, and they're also looking at other states that are offering the money as well.
That's true, Tom, but, you know, at some point, you have to stand up and say no. I mean, you know.
On the other hand, a lot of these guys need to feed their families. I mean, it would be a horrible decision to make. I think that, you know, I agree with Bernie Sanders that any state that offers tax incentives to a company that's in another state to move to that state should lose their federal highway funds. We need to put an end to this practice right now.
Well, you know, Boeing's just got a gun to everyone in Washington State's head, and they're going to extract what they want, and screw us. Because Jim McNerney, if he retired today, would get $246,000 a month.
Who is he?
And he's the CEO of Boeing.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
And they want to take away these guys' defined benefit pension plans.
Right. Yeah.
You know, I mean, and they're making billions of dollars a year.
Yeah. No, they just had one of their most profitable years ever, if my recollection is correct.
Right, and you got a Democratic Party that won't do anything for organized labor. We've been packing their water for 50 years.
Yeah.
And after the election's over, they kick us to the curb.
Let's not forget the role that the Republicans are playing in preventing the Democrats from being successful. The problem that you have is not a Washington State problem. It is a national problem. It is a problem that was created in 1947 when over two vetoes by Harry Truman, Taft-Hartley was passed through the House of Representatives and the Senate, and you know, which allowed states to go right to work for less. And it's a problem that needs to be solved with federal legislation. And the real shame is that back in the 60s, when Lyndon Johnson had enough political capital, when he was doing the war on poverty, to actually roll back Taft-Hartley, he didn't. And I think it's because he was a little wary of some of the unions at that time, and there were all the, you know, the problems that some of the unions were having with organized crime and whatnot. It's just the whole thing is tragic. But Chris, it's a tough one. Thanks for raising the issue, though. Appreciate the call. Thanks for the heads up. We'll be back. It's 10 minutes before you. Hey, thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to my executive producer, Sean Taylor, to our associate producer, Shane Farnan and Danielle Gilday, to our video director, Jim Javinsky, to our writer-researcher, Andrew Campbell and Nate Sweet, to Alva Goldbook for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, to our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, to everyone at our syndicators, Dow Global, Pacifica Radio, Sirius XM, CRN, Cable Radio Network, Free Speech TV on Dish Network, DirecTV, all the cable providers that carry our show, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Network, all the others around the country, to the great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on The Big Picture, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, and the folks in our chat room, to Alan Ratner and Victoria Jones and everyone at the Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Goodman Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors, our underwriters, and to you for supporting our program. Thank you. It is genuinely, genuinely appreciated. Lawrence in Berkeley, California. Hey, Lawrence, you want the last chapter of my book is wrong? What?
I wouldn't, you know, it's a matter of opinion. I mean, I loved your book. I mean,
We're talking about the crash of 2016.
The crash of 2016. It is full of all kinds of really great information and great theory. But your last epilogue chapter, A Letter to My Great-Grandchildren, made me smack my head and say, oh, no, do we have to do this again?
Yeah.
Well, let me explain. But you're talking about an 80-year cycle of depressions. You know, I know there's a cycle. I'm not sure about the 80 years. And therefore, you wrote a letter to your great-grandchildren saying, try to head it off again in, I guess it would now be 2097. Don't let the economic royalists take over again. And I thought, no, we don't have to go through this again, because there are many ways in which we can prevent, long before that, long before the cycle goes through it again, we can prevent the economic royalists from building up again. And I just wanted to give you one. It's really important.
Okay.
And that's from Sweden. It's known as the Meidner Plan. Meidner was the economist who really set up the welfare state in Sweden. And in the 70s, he came up with another plan which would every year tax corporate transfer stocks from corporations to their workers. And so it would be paid into the workers' welfare fund. But the point is that it, with those stocks would come a certain amount of voting power.
Right.
So that every year the workers would get more and more voting power within the stock exchange. And after a certain number of years, they would own the company. It never went through. Labor Party got cold feet. But the point is that, you know, we don't need to make the mistake, not mistake really, but bias that FDR made. He had a New Deal and he left the corporations in the hands of the capitalists.
Right.
And if you do that, they're always going to come back. They're always going to start the whole dreary cycle over again, you know, really starting not so much with the Powell memo, but what you were just talking about, 1947, the Taft-Hartley law against labor was, you know, really...
Yeah, in 35, when Roosevelt passed the Wagner Act, the National Labor Relations Act, he thought he finally had a bulwark, you know, a wall, a firewall that would protect labor from that point forward, and of course that got taken down in 47 after he was dead.
And that's the point, is that the capitalists, long before they start getting a monopoly on the money and start creating inequality again, will start building up their power.
Yeah, well, this is one of the reasons that one of the solutions that I recommend in the book is cooperatives, basically, you know, worker-owned cooperatives. Because what you're describing is how to make the transition from you know, raw capitalism to cooperative capitalism.
Exactly. And if you do it, you know, you can do it systematically such that there's preparation. You know, you don't have to storm the Bastille or you don't have to storm the Winter Palace.
Right.
If you have enough political power, you can arrange that all companies of a certain size, you know, I'm not saying your company, which doesn't have all that many workers, but let's say all companies over 100 workers will gradually transit to co-ops by means of what they have in Europe. You know, what they have in Europe now is that it's usually about a third of all the boards of directors have to be...
In Germany, it's 50% if you have more than 1,000 employees.
Yeah. Okay, but the law for the European Union is about a third.
Uh-huh.
They all have to be workers elected by workers. And if you just continue the process, sooner or later, all the large corporations will be workers' co-ops, and we won't have to go through this cycle anymore because there won't be any more economic royalists.
Right. Now, here's the one problem with that, and that I totally agree with you, Lawrence, and I think it's a brilliant suggestion. But you'll recall the sentence that you just finished began with the phrase, if you had enough political power. And how are you going to get that in a country where the real royalists, the Supreme Court, have said that money, which is political power, is actually protected under the First Amendment as constitutionally protected speech? How do you do it?
Well, if you elect enough of the right people for long enough, you'll have a Supreme Court that won't say that.
Well, that's remotely possible. I mean, the Supreme Court has been consistently saying that basically since the 1860s. But,
well,
you know.
1886, I think, was the railroad law.
Yeah, but, 1886 was Santa Clara.
There are other ways. You know, you can have an amendment, and you can have you can simply have enough union power and enough union power that is backed by neighborhoods that these laws will be reversed, and eventually you can transfer economic power to the workers.
Yeah, I think you're right. Lawrence, I think it's a great idea. It's, you know, the devil will be in the details. But thank you for the call, and thanks for sharing it. And thank you all for being with us this week, and look forward to seeing you next week, the first week of 2014. An election year. Time to start getting cranking, huh? Time to start getting active, because democracy is not a spectator sport. It does require your participation. Tag, you're it. Have a great weekend. We'll see you on Monday.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.